Hello and welcome to Who Are You, the podcast about what it means to be a football fan. From documentaries delving into the heart of a football club, to special guest interviews exploring the origins of their fandom. Every fan and every club has a story to tell, and we want to tell it. Over the course of this podcast, we will attempt to discover what really matters to fans, placing their stories in a broader footballing context. And with a new episode released every other Friday morning, it's the Who Are You fans who support by far the greatest team the world has ever seen. In this episode of Who Are You Talks, we speak to Twitter funny man, writer, and I don't know what else, Johnny Sharples. So the first thing, Johnny, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, yeah, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for letting me invite myself on, I think is the truth of what happened.
Well, we're glad to have you. We're glad that you invited yourself into our home. The first thing I'd like you to do is introduce yourself and a bit about who you are and your relationship to football, because frankly, at this point in time, I don't know.
I'm Johnny Sharples, and I think the best description of me for this podcast is that I do absolute nonsense on Twitter and try often too hard to make people laugh about football. And football is obviously a ripe platform for making jokes and stuff. So I sort of took it upon myself to do that and use Twitter and my relationship with football, I suppose, is just make jokes about it. I don't have a very good relationship with football based probably on who I chose to support as a child. And so I think I've made the best out of a bad situation from those decisions and taking them forward and using it as a platform to build often terrible jokes on.
I would argue with that. I don't think they're terrible jokes. I think they're very funny. We've both been through me during work and Dave just now having a look for your tweets, and congratulations, you can do tweets quite well. As your bio says, I believe, on Twitter, this is the citation maybe you need for someone to say that you're good at Twitter. For people that don't know or don't use Twitter or live in a box and don't really understand football Twitter, where can they follow you to start with?
Well, if they don't understand football Twitter, that's probably the best way to sort of, ignorance is bliss, I think, especially where football and Twitter combined are concerned. But if people are really desperate to jump and learn a bit more about it, then they can follow me at Johnny Gabriel and become one of my ludicrous number of followers. I was going to call them idiots, but if they listen to this, then I'd do them a disservice, and I don't really mean it, but... yeah, they can follow me there if they're absolutely desperate for someone to follow.
Lovely, wonderful. We'll get on with the actual interview now rather than sticking with that. As you sort of briefly alluded to there, you've chosen a team. I've got a recent tweet by yourself. It's a quote retweet. The original tweet saying, "Make one mistake and you get punished for a lifetime." You responded with me reflecting on my decision to support Newcastle.
Can I also point out at this point that he's retweeted it himself as well?
So that's the best way to get numbers. Retweet it. Tweet something, and then at an optimum time when something else happens, retweet yourself. Pro tip for anyone listening.
Wow. I'm hoping that's the first of many pro tips so I can use them myself. But if you wouldn't mind starting by explaining your decision to support Newcastle.
My parents have absolutely no interest in football, very little interest in sport as a whole. As a kid, we were mainly brought up watching rally driving and Formula One, and not to discredit either of those sports, but it's not that, I suppose fast cars are quite exciting when you're a kid, but it didn't really give me the sort of thing. I can't really aspire to be one of those people. So I was sort of in a rut. And as a kid growing up, I had no interest in football because I had no reference points to either of my parents. And that was until Euro 96 happened. And at some point along the line, I decided I was going to watch it. And I don't know where that desire to watch the matches came from, because neither of my parents watched it. And my brother was about 18 at the time. Was obviously, if he wanted to watch the football, he was out getting drunk in pubs and watching football that way. So I don't know whether it was someone at school mentioned it, whether we'd done a special day at school, because England had obviously done well, but the Euro 96 semi-finals, the first thing I can really remember watching, and England scored within about 10 minutes. And just the atmosphere of watching it on television just encapsulated me as a kid. And the guy that scored that goal was Alan Shearer. And from then on in, I was suckered into everything Alan Shearer did. And the next time I saw him on the news, I knew he sort of played for Blackburn because a lot of kids at school supported Blackburn because I grew up not very far away from Blackburn in Preston. So I think a lot of kids at school supported Blackburn and I had sort of a tacit idea of who Alan Shearer was. And then he was on telly and he was this amazing guy scoring goals, and then they'd reflect on it at like half time and say that's his like fifth goal of the tournament, and it's like, well, he's pretty good then. And then he joined Newcastle, and so I decided, regrettably in hindsight, to support Newcastle as well. And it's been a journey, and it's all Alan Shearer's fault.
Yeah, we can definitely come on to memories good and mainly bad of Newcastle later in the podcast. But I'm interested because the kind of traditional route into football support, I know it was for me and Ben, it's either where you're from or who your dad is. They tend to be where most, certainly the kids my age, started getting into football. Either that or you supported Man United because they were good. I'm interested in how it developed from you watching Alan Shearer on telly to becoming a Newcastle fan, if you know what I mean. By what was your kind of Saturday like? When did you start like looking out for Newcastle's results and things like that?
I think to say my mum and dad didn't like football, or they were really supportive of my decision to sort of jump all guns blazing, I don't think I really did it by halves. I don't think you do anything by halves at the age I was when I started supporting Newcastle. So they were really good in indulging my sort of newfound, because it could have been a thing, like when you're that age, things come and go in an instant. There's a lot of fads, you know. When I was a kid, it was like Pogs and stuff like that. So this could have just been another one of the things. I wanted to support Newcastle, but 6 months later, I don't want to support Newcastle anymore. I don't want to like football anymore, you know. But they were really good, and they sort of really encouraged me. My grandparents as well had absolutely no interest in football, but still, I remember my nan would collect tokens from the local newspaper, well, not the local newspaper, but one of the national newspapers, and then you could pick like a guide for the upcoming season from whatever Premiership club you wanted, and she got me a Newcastle one, so I'd read that cover to cover, and then anything I could get hold of, like the newspapers, scan through and look for a Newcastle result, and teletext was where absolutely everything happened. And there might be some people that listen to this that don't know what teletext is, and it's basically the internet with about four pages of the internet all in like 16-bit. But like that was opened up a whole world of like page 302. I can still remember it now as the football page, and it'd have all the headlines, and just scanning through and looking for a Newcastle headline and just reading it and hoping the page didn't flick over too quick before you got to the end of the thing and going back. And then, yeah, Saturday would be teletext, like trying to find, you know, often on teletext, it wouldn't tell you who was in the team. It just literally showed Newcastle were playing, say, Man United or City or Everton or someone, and you just wait for a score. And the first idea you've had was who was playing, was if one of them scored, and like Shearer will pop up, and it's like, oh, good, Alan Shearer's playing today, we might win, or Ferdinand will pop up, or Rob Lee. And it's like, oh, that's who's in the team today. And sometimes you won't find out who was in the team until the end of the season when I got one of them little books and go, I remember we played someone here who was in the team that day. I can't believe he's dropped Shearer for that. It's like, it's a bit too late now. But yeah, that's sort of, I was really indulged in how I became a football supporter, and I bought the kits and bought all sorts of just random stuff, especially anything that had Alan Shearer on it. Mm. I think I got bought like Corinthian figures. They brought out some like mugs with Alan Shearer's face molded on it. I got bought one of those. It's a bit like that scene in Alan Partridge. Like my bedroom as a kid, if Alan Shearer ever came round, he'd have just been terrified. Luckily, they don't let you tattoo your body with Alan Shearer's face when you're 10 years old, so it didn't go quite that far. But absolutely anything to do with Newcastle, I was all over it.
Have you ever met Alan Shearer?
No, I think I've probably at this point got a restraining order that I'm not aware of. But no, he follows me on Twitter, which was a childhood dream come true when it happened. And occasionally he'll like my tweets, and it's like, oh, so that's what Alan Shearer likes. That's his level. And then try and aim everything just at Alan Shearer. But no, I've not been that lucky, and he's not been that unlucky just yet.
Was it anything more than his goals that kind of made you fall in love with Alan Shearer? Would you see him get interviewed or something, and just would it be the way he played the game? Or was it literally just he scored a lot of goals?
I'll be honest, if you saw an interview with Alan Shearer in 1996, that would not have piqued my childhood interest, because he's a lovely man, but he was very focused as a footballer, and that didn't really, you know, obviously now he's got good banter about him and stuff like that, but I think as a footballer, he was so focused that he didn't have time for it. But I think it was literally just my awareness of football was the team that score the most goals is the one that win, which is obviously what football is. And the one that was scoring the most goals was Alan Shearer, so he was obviously the best at football. And I think that's all it was. I think I just wanted to... It was glory support, really. I just wanted to support the best team, who Newcastle never were anyway, that had the best player or players, and Alan Shearer was the best player because he scored the most goals. And that's simply, I think, all that it took for me to support Newcastle. And I've had to stick with it ever since. And yeah, we don't have the best players in the world anymore. But
bit of a sliding doors moment, because he nearly went to Man United, and you could have been a Man United supporter now.
Yeah, I could have been a Man United supporter, and I think I'd have had at least a couple of trophies. I know technically I've seen Back to the Future. I know if you change one thing in the past, it affects everything going forward. So if Alan Shearer joined Man United, they might not have won as many trophies as they have, but I'm sure I'd have still had one or two to celebrate. And you know, if he could have stayed at Blackburn, he had offers to stay at Blackburn from Jack Walker, and he could have stayed there, and I'd have probably gone, I'll support Blackburn then. And if he joined Blackburn, or stayed at Blackburn or joined Man United, I probably could have gone and watched them play. But he went to Newcastle, and that's 200 miles away from where I grew up with parents that didn't like football. And so it was very difficult for me to go and watch Newcastle play. And obviously that's why I had to settle for CFAX and Teletext and, you know, see on Club Call adverts who we might have been linked to and try and do it like a cryptic crossword and work out what player they were referring to. So, it was a bit of a sliding doors moment. He could have gone abroad, and had great difficulty trying to support like Juventus or Barcelona and justify that. It's hard enough justifying supporting Newcastle, but at least in the same country.
Yeah. How did you justify it? Did your friends say anything to you about suddenly becoming a Newcastle fan?
I got called, got called a glory supporter, which looking back is ironic, because we have had absolutely no glory over the past 22 years that I've supported Newcastle. But I think children at that age understand it. In my school... My best mate, who I've known since I was a kid, supports Everton, and another one of our friends supports Dundee United. So the school we went to, there was never obviously, and you know, we had a lot of Preston supporters. No one supported the big teams. No one supported the Man Uniteds or the City weren't that big then, but like Liverpool, and there was like kids supported Arsenal. No one really cares at that age, I don't think. No one really has a real understanding of what real football support actually is. So I think I got away with it. And then by the time people realise what it is, my support of Newcastle had sort of been established. And it was just that there's Johnny, supports Newcastle. What an idiot.
When did you go to your first game?
2009. So 13 years of supporting Newcastle. I've never gone to see Newcastle play. I got taken to the stadium. Like I say, my mum and dad were so indulgent in me. My sister would probably say spoilt, but and it's probably the right word looking back. But we used to go caravanning. My mum and dad still go caravanning now, but we stayed close to Newcastle. I think we stayed in County Durham somewhere, and they took me to the outside of St James's Park, and I got to just have a look at it. And it wasn't as big as it is now, but it was still big, and I think that was the first time I'd been to a football stadium. I don't think I'd been to Deepdale at that point. And it's just massive, especially as a little kid, just looking up at it, and it's huge. And I got taken to the Metro Centre and got the club shop and stuff like that. But it was just so expensive as a kid. And if I got something, then my sister and brother are older than me, but you obviously have to replicate it for them. So yeah, 2009, Newcastle got relegated, obviously, into the Championship, which meant they got to play Preston, which is where I lived. And then got a ticket and went and watched Preston on a horrid, I think it was a Monday night, it could have been something, a freezing cold in November. and Newcastle won 1-0. I think Kevin Nolan might have been the goal scorer. And that's the first time I ever went to a Newcastle match. And it was, you hype things up. Mm. And you know, like, we're in the Championship. We've got, you know, Danny Simpson, obviously the Premier League winner now. you had Danny Simpson playing for you, and you had, like, not the greatest team. Alan Smith was still in midfield. Danny Guthrie isn't the sort of caliber of player that I supported when I was younger. But it was still amazing. I got to see them win, and, you know, I've seen them play Preston a few times, home and away, seen them at Wigan, seen them against QPR. So now I've got the money to do it for myself, and I've got the means to travel and up to Newcastle or travel around the country. I don't have to rely on my parents' generosity or them spoiling me. I can go and see them wherever and whenever I can be bothered to hand Mike Ashley my money.
So how would you compare your support now, being able to go to the occasional game, compared to that teletext days of waiting? And I just about remember watching, because that was, I'm, as you can probably tell, I was a similar relationship to my club, except my dad did support them, so we went occasionally up north, or to Stoke. But a lot of it was radio or teletext. But it was just, I guess it was probably, my childhood was later, so I don't remember it loads. But there was a definite thrill in waiting for the page to turn to your team, and that's very different to what it is now.
Yeah, I think now you have the internet. You have streams, which are obviously the main difference. I think if streams existed when I was a kid, then I would have opened my eyes to a whole new world of pop-up adverts. But it would have been great. It doesn't matter where you are in the world or what time zone you're in or anything. You can click on a stream and watch it. And that's often how my support is now. If I can't get to a match, which is, you know, I've got older, Newcastle ain't got any closer. It's still however many miles. I've got further away, if anything, because I moved to Salford, which is a bit further away from Newcastle than Preston was. But now I can stream things. I can find out the latest. I can go on Twitter and just hashtag NUFC and see who the latest player we're linked with is. Go on YouTube, find out who he is. It's not a matter of £1.50 club calls to find out who the, you know, the former England international we're being linked with is, and it turns out it's an under-18s international or something like that. So the support now is a lot easier than it was as a kid. I think when I was a kid, I didn't think that I had two seasons. I had a season that finished second the year before we finished second, two FA Cup finals, and then some Champions League football, and then it just stopped, coincidentally, when Mike Ashley took over. So I don't have the highs that I used to have, but I do have the ease of access to everything that's going on. So, you know, you've got to take the peaks with the troughs. And I think we're in a trough in terms of the football, but we're in a peak in terms of my access to it.
And I suppose another key difference is, with Newcastle going the way they've gone, is you now have a whole new resource for Twitter comedy now.
Yeah, I think often get criticized. I don't get criticized, but people often tweet me and say, "Why?" Especially when I do like stuff for other bigger accounts and stuff, I'll use their Twitter accounts to sort of do jokes and stuff. And you get criticized that you're always taking the mick out of Liverpool, you're always taking the mick out of United or City or Arsenal. And it's like, the team I take the mick out of the most is Newcastle, because I know the most about them and I feel the most comfortable taking the mick out of them, because I don't care. If I'm not one of the, I've never been one of these people that's very, my football club is a football club, it's a means of entertainment, it's not a family member. So if someone takes the mick out of it, it's not a friend, it's a business. If someone takes the mick out of it, I don't care, it's funny. A lot of people take it very personally. But yeah, it's opened up this whole avenue of, you know, black comedy and sort of, you know, gallows humour. And I think you just have to accept that for all the joy that we don't have, the jokes make up for it sometimes. And I know I'd rather see us lift a trophy than be able to get a tweet that gets 1,000 retweets. But
that's very brave of you to admit
I'll admit that now. I'd rather see us win the Carabao Cup than have 1,000 retweets. And I'll put that on my epitaph.
It's funny that you say that about the current Newcastle team being able to take the mickey out of them, because a lot of your bits on Twitter, if people aren't aware, are to do with that team in the 90s, which is funny when they were, as you say, a figment of teletext where it wasn't like you're watching. I don't know. How did you how did you watch them? Did you? Was there ever any? Like, I don't know that because I wasn't around.
We didn't have Sky, so I never watched them on telly unless Channel 5 had the rights to the Cup Winners' Cup and the UEFA Cup. So I'd watch them on Channel 5 once a week if we'd managed to fluke our way into... Well, we were good then. Managed to lose a cup final and get our way into the Cup Winners' Cup. So I think I did watch a little bit on telly. So eventually you got to know who some of these players were. But yeah, the love that I have for the 90s team, they're the ones that made me love Newcastle as a whole. Not just Alan Shearer, because like one of my favourite players growing up, obviously Alan Shearer, Rob Lee and David Ginola were the first lot of players I absolutely adored, and Les Ferdinand and Philippe Albert, who is...
Did he score any famous goals, perhaps?
He scored one against Tottenham where he played on the last shoulder of the last defender. I don't know if that's the one you're referring to. but he, yeah, it was difficult to watch them, and I think maybe that's why I love them so much, because they are almost an enigma in some respects that I didn't see enough of them at the time. I can go and watch them now, YouTube compilations. You can go and watch full matches from the 90s now, which is what I do on the cold Salford nights. log onto the internet and watch these people play. So I think a lot of my love is the fact that these players were what I made them in my mind. I think I didn't know for a long time Philippe Albert had a moustache until I was quite a bit older. But yeah, these players were what you made them. And in my head, I could make them the best players in the world, which is what I essentially did with Alan Shearer, put him on a pedestal. But, you know, Philippe Albert is, to me, one of the greatest defenders in football history. But when you watch these programmes, you'll never see him alongside Baresi or Cannavaro or Bobby Moore. He should be, rightfully, that's his rightful place in the world. But now he's just a fruit and veg seller in Belgium, and people don't remember him for the magnificent central defender that he was. So, yeah, I just eulogise them in my mind and hope that it was somewhere close to the truth. And I think a lot of Newcastle fans that did get to watch them think the same. And I think obviously those words that I read on teletext or in newspaper reports or Match magazine must have been right.
Were you making jokes about football kind of way before you had a Twitter account? Because what I think comes across following you on Twitter is something that the football media in general tends to ignore, is that football is essentially just a bit of a laugh at the end of the day. And I dare say there's studios not far from where we are now in Media City where there'll be several men gathered around the table really getting in depth on a tactical decision Mourinho made last week. And they'll be talking really seriously about it and kind of going to town on something that, when we all step back and look at it, isn't important. And I think that's what comes across from the way you talk about football on your Twitter account and in other places. So before Twitter, were you writing blogs? Were you making jokes amongst your friends about football?
I think I've always made jokes watching football because the stupid stuff that happens in football has always happened. But maybe previously, before the advent of the internet and stuff like that, before I had access to it in the same way that I have now, you'd make the jokes while you were watching football and you may have got two of your mates laughing. Well, that's enough. You still get the, you know, hormone release or whatever in your brain. It's still like, yeah, that was a good one. If only I had some way of writing it down in 140 characters. But spoiler alert, Dave and I used to be on a football forum together. And I think that was a right place for a lot of jokes. And I hope that I would make the same jokes then as I make now. It's not a thing that... I've honed. I think I was a lot more serious in my discussion of things back then. I think that's what happens when you have a lot of people in one place, I think. But yeah, football is stupid. And I think sometimes you need to step back and accept. And maybe it's the fact that Newcastle aren't competing for trophies. And for a long time, we've had two relegations, but we've been mid-table for a lot of the time. We've not been competing one way or the other, competing, you know, trying to keep our heads above water or for Europe. And I think when that happens, you can take a step back and you can say, yeah, football is stupid and these stupid things happen, and they happen every season. The same thing happens. A manager will say something stupid, or, you know, something will happen in a match that happened years ago, and people are always doing stupid things. Michy Batshuayi at the World Cup kicking the football into the post and smacking him in the face. But that was happening on like videos, you know, like VHS Nick Hancock videos when I was growing up, and you'd see them all and stuff like that. So it has always been this ripe environment for stupidity. And I think I did have a go at writing blogs, and people did it better. So you have to, you know, you wrap it up and you don't do it again because you realise that there's people better than you. There's people better than me at Twitter, but it ain't stopped me. So I think you realise that you just got to carve your niche. And I think, especially in terms of Newcastle and stupid stuff that happens, hopefully I've done that.
So what do you think of the current team? Obviously, we've mentioned Mike Ashley. This podcast is normally going more in-depth into sort of the current predicament of a club. Newcastle would be a great club for Who Are You to cover at some point. I'm sure we will. We'll do sort of a whole season on it, maybe. I don't know. But what is your relationship with the club now in terms of, do you love them still the same?
I think I love being a Newcastle United supporter. The only problem is it comes with the caveat of having to support Newcastle. by which I mean, like, the fans are still great. You go to a match and, you know, especially through Twitter, you meet other Newcastle fans, you get to go up to Newcastle, you've spoken to them, it's not awkward, you can go and hang out with them and complain about the team. But the club is horrible. I think we've got the best manager that we've had since Sir Bobby was in charge. We've probably got one of the best central defenders and captains we've had for a long time. Newcastle have never been blessed with centre-backs, apart from Philippe Aubert and Jonathan Woodgate. But we've got probably the best captain we've had since Alan Shearer retired. Apart from that, maybe Jonjo Shelvey would probably walk into pretty much any Newcastle team while I've been supporting them. But apart from that, we've just not had the investment. Mike Ashley's there to I can't believe you made me talk sincerely about football. Mike Ashley is there to earn his money, and, you know, he sells the players when they're at a premium and then doesn't reinvest it, so he's got his profits. And that's just sort of how we have to resign ourselves until someone takes charge of the club, and hopefully they'll see what a good thing that they have in terms of Newcastle, that they've got the fan base there, they've got a stadium there, the stadium needs a bit of work, but they've still got a 52,000 seat stadium that gets filled every week, regardless of who the opposition is and who the owner is, and we've got a good catchment area for footballers that we've never ever really made complete use of. We had a few in the 90s. Robbie Elliott came through, Steve Howe came through, Steve Watson came through, Lee Clark came through, and they were good Premier League players. Since then, we've had dribs and drabs. Paul Dummett, who's won me over mainly because Javier Manquillo came in, and I hate Javier Manquillo more than I ever hated Paul Dummett. But we had Andy Carroll and Schuller, I mean, with Stephen Taylor, Tim Krull, I suppose, and Fraser Forster. But you've got this massive area to get young players through, and we've never made use of it. And if someone can, you see what Sheikh Mansour did at City, and he really bought into the whole area and wanted to make an academy so the kids would come there. And Newcastle arguably have a big area than that, because we've not got a United trying to pinch players, and we've got Everton, and we've not got Liverpool, and we've not got even this, like, Wigan smaller club. Blackburn can poach good young players because they've got the promise of first team football. We've got Sunderland, who have a very good academy, and then that's Middlesbrough sort of there and thereabouts, and they have a good academy as well, so we need to make more of it, and hopefully we will going forward. But now the love for the club's still there, it's just made very difficult to love it.
You mentioned your Newcastle jokes are part of your Twitter niche. Some people might call it your Twitter brand, if that's not too pretentious a way to put it. But another part of that is Football Manager, which I think even either today or yesterday I saw a tweet of yours referencing something your assistant manager says to you on Football Manager. And for those in the know, they find that hilarious, and the Football Manager fans on Twitter can come up with these amazing kind of inside jokes and references to the game and stuff. And obviously it's a huge thing, but there are other huge football games as well. But the thing I've noticed with Football Manager fans, more so than people who play FIFA a lot or PES, the people who love Football Manager, really love Football Manager. Why is that? As a guilty look appears.
My love of Football Manager basically came because, like you say, I didn't have access to the internet. I didn't have access to, you know, live football. So I got onto Championship Manager 93, which had been released a few years beforehand, before I became a football supporter. But it allowed me to sort of get this in-depth knowledge of football that my friends who had access to, you know, Sky Sports, or could go to the actual match and get a match day programme and flick through that. So Championship Manager gave me this sort of insight into the world of football. I got to learn about different players. I got to realise that John Fashanu wasn't just the guy that presented Gladiators. He was a footballer as well, which blew my mind as a kid. Just two jobs. No, he's a footballer that happens to present and wear bad waistcoats. That blew my mind. But Football Manager is so in-depth. I think people get so involved in it in a way that they don't with FIFA and Pro Evo. FIFA and Pro Evo are really social games. So if you... I used to do it before the internet started. Before you got broadband and you could play online, me and my mates would play football, play FIFA together, or play Pro Evo together, and we'd sit and we'd talk. And you'd talk to each other and you'd half watch what was going on the pitch to make sure you won. And then the rest of the time, you took the mick out of your mate because you won. And you talked about what was happening and what were you doing at school, what you were doing at college, whatever. Football Manager is very antisocial. because you play on a laptop, that gives you a barrier to anyone else. And you have to be so involved because there's so many nuances in the game that you have to get your head around. You have to get your head around training, have to get your head around scouting, have to get your head around transfers, contract negotiations, all this different stuff, and it doesn't leave you very much time to be a sociable person. And so I think that's why people are all in on it. And there's so much stuff that happens in Championship Manager, but it always follows the same path. And that's why you can say something that your assistant manager will say and everyone knows what you mean, because everyone's seen that thing happen, or everyone knows who Freddie Adu is, or everyone knows who Kerlon is, because they've had to go and look for these gems if they want to be good at the game themselves. And you've got to search deep to really get yourself involved in it. And I don't think that happens with Pro Evo or with FIFA. And then Championship Manager, if you're good at FIFA, you're probably good at football in real life. But if you're good at Championship Manager, you're not that good, so you've got a lot of time to play it. That was especially how it was with me anyway.
Do you think it genuinely affects the way you watch football now? Because either something you've seen in the game happens in real life, or, like you said, the phenomenon of the Football Manager player will appear. Do you think it either kind of... does it increase your knowledge of the game, or does it kind of maybe alter the way you watch football?
I think it alters the way you play it, because especially if you've just had a World Cup, or if you've just had the Euros, or you're watching a Champions League match where it's maybe not a team you've watched before, and a guy pops up, and you're like, I signed him about 5 years ago on Football Manager, or I signed him on Championship Manager, and you can't escape that. you'll be sat there going, scratching your brain and going, where do I know that name from? And it's like, oh, he scored against me in the Champions League final. And then you automatically dislike him. There's a Jason Manford joke where he met Michael Richards and was it was really horrible to Michael Richards. And then he's thinking, why did I do that? And apparently Michael Richards had turned up late for training like a few times on Football Manager. So it doesn't impact you in that sense. But I don't think it makes you any more knowledgeable about football in real life. It makes you more knowledgeable about Football Manager. And I think that's where it ends. I think anyone that tries to say otherwise is being pretentious, or which is bold of me to say, or is trying to sort of give themselves more kudos than really they deserve. And all that kudos goes to the research of Football Manager in truth. But it's... I'm into... The one game on Football Manager I play is on Football Manager 2013, and I'm in 2063 with Celtic, and I'm 83 years old, and no real people are left in the game, like not even as managers, not even as scouts. So, like, none of these people are showing up in real football. So it's an escapism, and it's good in one sense, but that especially doesn't impact, unless, you know, if football starts following that exact path, then that will be something else. And I'm Celtic manager by the time I'm 83. I'm not holding that much hope. Brendan Rodgers is doing a good job. So I won't be going after his job just yet. But I think Championship Manager and Football Manager are amazing games, and they can send me a free copy whenever they want.
And I don't know that much about football. I'm not a Football Manager person, to be honest.
I've call them nerds. It's yeah.
Just thinking the right word. Avicii Strock.
The greatest footballer of all time.
Explain.
Avicii Strock is a random assortment of pixels and numbers and things. For the uninitiated, when the real life players start retiring, the game just randomly repopulates them with fictional players. And obviously I was Celtic manager, and in 2020, which shows how long I've been playing this, as if the number 2063 didn't give that away. In 2020, I needed a new striker, Mobido Maiga, who used to play for West Ham and Senegal or Cameroon, I think. He was my best striker, as was Georgios Samaras, which shows you the level that we were operating at. So I needed a new striker and sent my scouts out all over the world. And then I got this report on my fictional desk for Avicii Strock, who was playing at Zagreb. Not Dinamo Zagreb, the good one, some second division Zagreb. But he was amazing. And you click on, you see the little WNT, which means there's other people looking at him. You click on that and there'd be Real Madrid were there, and Barcelona be there, and Chelsea were there, and Paris Saint-Germain were there. And it's like, well, he's not going to join me, is he? He's not going to come and play up front with Georgios Samaras and have Scott Brown trying to feed him through balls. But then he did. And then he scored 1,000 goals in professional football. And he won us 4 Champions Leagues. And he became the greatest footballer in the world. And he never won the Ballon d'Or. And it's still a sore point now because I've had worse players than him who have won it. but yeah, I got a shirt printed. Well, someone bought me a shirt with his name printed on the back that went in the Football Museum in Manchester. We made football programs for his testimonial and had them printed off and sold them and gave the proceeds to charity. And I have a Corinthian figure of him that someone made for me. I have like match attacks cards with his face on. And if you think the Alan Shearer thing as a kid was a bit Alan Partridge when he goes to a fan's house, at least Alan Shearer was real. Avicii Strock, I have all sorts of stuff around my flat with his face on it. But he was phenomenal. There've been better players than him since. But none of them have sort of captured my imagination quite like he did.
So what was the jump from him being that combination of code in your game to him taking on a life of his own? His shirt was in the Football Museum. Let's not kid ourselves. That is odd. That is very, very odd. what happens between him being a good character in a football game to him kind of being real in a sense?
Well, it's a strange story, I'll admit that much. But it sort of was born out of a tragedy, basically. My brother passed away in 2014, and I just needed something to do, because when you're sort of hanging around waiting for a funeral, there's nothing to do. It was around Christmas time and New Year time. And so I just needed something to do. So I played Football Manager, and then sort of I was all right at doing Photoshop things. And your mind's in a strange place when you're grieving. So I decided I'd be like Frankenstein, and Avicii Strock would be my monster, and I'd put his head on like Serge from Kasabian's body scoring at Soccer Aid, or I put him on Georgios Samaras's body, and his body shape changed a lot, like all throughout that time. And then I put it on Twitter, and people seemed to find it weird, which it was, or find it funny. And then I thought, the market for Football Manager and the market for the people most likely to take their own lives, which is what happened with my brother, are sort of one in the same. And so I can use this weird, weird thing as sort of a force for good. And that's what happened, and people sort of bought into it, and the charity that we raised money for thought it was an interesting idea and sort of went with it as well. So I think if my brother could see it, he would think it was the strangest thing. I think I wouldn't hear the end of it. But I'm glad some good has come out of my stupid brain at some point. And yeah, to get it in the football museum and to sell these things is great and very, very strange.
I remember following that Ivica Strox Twitter account, and you properly went to town on the photoshops. I mean, I remember him being the face of Bookfast. I remember him on magazine covers, posing with trophies that he, well, obviously he never won them, but the trophies he won in the game and stuff. Yeah, how did you kind of pitch that? First of all, what was the charity you associated that with, and how did you kind of pitch that to them?
So the charity was CALM, which is the Campaign Against Living Miserably, which is a men's mental health charity, suicide prevention charity, because suicide is the biggest killer of men under the age of 50. And like I say, that's sort of combined with the lads most likely to play Football Manager, obviously, young men under the age of 50 as well. So it was sort of an easy sell in that respect. It's like there's these two demographics that are very similar but seem to be quite far apart from one another. Would it help if I just pushed them a bit closer together? And how do you sell that to somebody? I didn't sell it to CALM initially. The first people that was sort of picked up an interest in it was Vice. And I sort of don't think they sort of just saw Ivica Strox and they saw this Twitter account and thought, that's a bit of a weird thing. Why doesn't this guy write about it? And I submitted my copy, and halfway through that copy is just, my brother died. And it's like, oh, okay. And then they offered me money for it, and I said, can you donate that to CALM instead? So they went to CALM, and then I spoke to CALM, and then they said, oh, this is quite an interesting idea. How far can you go with it? So that's when I did the... I wanted to do something physical with Ivica Strox anyway, which is how the programmes came up. And then I realised there's no point. I looked how much it costs to print things. And to print one thing of something is very expensive. To print 150 of them is still expensive, but it works its way out. So I printed 150 of them and kept a couple for myself and sold the rest for charity and said to CALM, I'm doing this thing. Can I give you the money from it? And obviously they were more than happy to receive that. They can put it to really good use, much better use than I would have put it to, because I'd have probably had about 10 more of each of Strox shirts in different sizes and home and away and all this sort of stuff. And I got really lucky in that a guy that works for CALM called Neil is a Newcastle supporter, and he sort of knows a lot about football and sort of knows about Football Manager. And he was really encouraging of it, and he wanted me to write something, and he shared it through CALM's Twitter account whenever it happened. And whenever I was able to talk about it. So, yeah, it's strange. One of their figureheads, they have more, they have like Professor Green and Ramesh Ranganathan are their a couple of their figureheads now. But for a while, on a lot of stuff that they would post on Twitter and Facebook, it was a Ivica Strox head. And I don't know how people reacted to that. I hope they reacted well to it and it made them click on the link and find out a bit more about the charity. But yeah, for a while, it was very strange. Strange is a word that I've used a lot to describe Ivica Strox. There's no other pseudonym that would work and cover it as much as strange as it is a weird thing.
Having a look at your Twitter, you're still working with CALM today. It's a relationship that you maintain. Where do you see that going with CALM? What do you want from your relationship with CALM?
Nothing. I just want CALM to be in the back of people's minds, especially. I have a modest following on Twitter, and most of them will be young men. I talk a lot about football, and I think the main audience for football is still, it's very male dominated sport, very male dominated pastime. And I think most of my followers that follow me for sports reasons are going to be people that fall in the age bracket of CALM. And I want that always to be in the back of their minds, whether it's for them and they need someone to turn to and talk to about what's going on in their lives, or whether they have a friend that they know is struggling and they're able to talk to it, they're able to direct them towards CALM, or whether they just want to raise some money at work, raise some money at school, raise some money at college or university, and they're sort of bereft of ideas of who needs that money. And CALM are a really good option because they're doing amazing work, and it's in a field that needs the money directed towards it. I'm not going to sit here and complain about the funding that we have towards mental health services, I'll just say it's nowhere near enough, especially when you consider how high the suicide rates are and mental health rates are, and how one in four of us at some point will, you know, struggle with our mental health. The money just isn't in place and the professionals aren't in place. So CALM have to be a safety net and the Samaritans have to be a safety net for where the NHS is stretched and struggling because it's not getting the funding it needs. And I think CALM always needs to be in the back of people's heads. And I think it's weird where it's come from. When I first got involved with CALM after my brother passed away, I'd never heard of them before. Nobody I spoke to had really heard of them before. They were a very small charity. They had a very small number of staff. I went and did stuff and talked about CALM, and people thought it was a charity that I'd set up. And I would have loved to have set up a charity like CALM. I don't have the time. I don't think I have the patience to be able to think this. But I just want people, more and more people to know it's out there and know it's an option available to them or to their friends or to their brother, their dad, their sons, their friends, their whoever. I just really, really hope that people just acknowledge it's there and make use of them.
Well, I hope people listening today and who have enjoyed the chat, head over to CALM. I will talk to you about a link or something or somewhere to go to donate.
Yeah, I think I was a lot more passionate about CALM than I have ever been about Newcastle United, which I think shows where we're heading now.
Well, that was one of my thoughts on what you were saying. Is this demographic similar? It's the same demographic for football. This isn't just Football Manager. So do you think that football maybe has a part to play? Through Who Are You, I don't know how many episodes you've listened to, but every time we go, we speak to people where football, this is their life. Like, without their football club, you don't know what they would do in a sense. So do you think there needs to be done more from a football? I don't know. And football, I'm saying football like this is, sorry, I'm saying football like it's this huge thing. But is it football clubs? I don't know, other football fans. Like, what could be done more for this subject, for male suicide, for CALM, campaign for
living miserably
in football?
I think football's slowly making the steps it needs to make. You look at the back of the Football League shirts this season and they've got the Mind logo on there. And even if people, I've done searches on Twitter because Mind have done amazing things to get their name out there, but people look at the back of a footballer's shirt that's playing for Stoke in the Championship, for instance, or playing for Preston or playing for Plymouth or Exeter or whoever, and they'll see the name on the back of the shirt and they'll see this weird squiggle at the start of it, and you see people go on Twitter and go, what the hell is this squiggle? And then someone will go, oh, it's for Mind, and then give them a link to Mind. And even something small like that is making inroads into where it needs to be. Football, you say it's not this like a big thing, but it is a huge thing for everyone in this, for a lot of people in this country. And it's got the target market that needs to be spoken to about the mental health services and the charities that are out there. And football's really great at being reactive to these things. You saw when Gary Speed passed away a number of years ago, the outpouring of grief and love for him. And when it happened with Aaron Lennon a few years ago now, just down the road in Salford, he got, you know, taken in under the Mental Health Act, and how the outpouring of love for him came through. But you need to put things in place before that happens. It's all well and good doing it after it happens, but and it's going to help more people in the long run. But for someone like Aaron Lennon, he needed the services before he reached crisis point. And so you need to put these things in place for the PFA, for players, for ex-players who all struggle with coming to terms with the end of their career, looking for new jobs. Not everyone can go and be a pundit on Match of the Day or can go and work for Five Live or BT Sport. There's some people that their football career ends and they've got to go and retrain in a whole new field and learn new skills that, you know, they've been in academy since they were kids and they've never, it's going to sound cruel, but they've never known the real world and known what it's like to go out and sit through a job interview and things like that. And they have to face up to that now. And you get rejected at job interviews, especially if you have no experience. You can't sit down and say, I used to be a professional footballer. How's that going to help you pick up the phone at a call centre or something like that? So they need to know that if things aren't going their way, that there are options available to them. And it can be something simple as Mind, obviously, will have things in match day programmes and stuff with their telephone number and their website. It's just little things like that, that when you're flicking through, you'll see something and say, oh yeah, that's something I can turn to. I know my friend is struggling and I can help them through that. So I think football is slowly getting there, but there's still a long way to go, and I think there's still a lot that needs to be done. But it does look like they're making those steps really positively and in the right direction.
And on the kind of fan perspective, I mean, we're a podcast about football fans, and obviously we've seen our audio boom analytics. We know that the audience for this podcast will be men in that age demographic as well. What would your advice be to people who feel like they're struggling with something like that? What would be your kind of first port of call?
I think we're really strongly, you see it in every mental health campaign, that it's okay to talk, but often they don't say who to talk to, or they often just think it's really easy to talk. You know, all I've been waiting for was someone to say it was okay, and now, you know, all the words will come flooding out my mouth. It's not that simple. I think the first thing to do is sort of maybe write something down that you would like to say, and then read it back to yourself. And if that's how you're feeling, then you can go and broach that with someone that you trust. And it doesn't have to be a GP, and it doesn't have to be a charity. It could just be someone that you go and watch football with, or it could be someone that you go to the pub with, or someone you play football with. And if someone, we're often focused on the person that needs to talk, whereas a lot of the time we need to focus on the people that should be listening. And it's not easy to hear your friend say that they're struggling. I know after my brother passed away, you feel a lot of guilt of whether you could have done more, or you don't know what to say back to them, or you wouldn't know what to say back to them. But sometimes they just need someone to listen and not react. They just need to get it out there. And then you can start maybe treating them normally again. You know, you just go, all right, well, we'll probably invite you to the pub a bit more often, or we'll probably, you know, go and watch the football together a bit more often, or we'll go and do something else. So I think it shouldn't be a burden on anyone, and you're not being a burden on anyone by going to talk to them. And if someone is struggling and comes to talk to you, there are other services that you can say, well, I don't know what I'm doing, but these people might, or you can say, they'll say it to you, and you can go away and look on these websites or look at these things and see what resources are out there. And there's so many good things. Like, I've met so many good mental health writers that have written about stuff like this, and you can, you know, read up on it, the practical things to do as well. You don't have to just offer emotional support. There's practical support as well. So I think there's so much more to do than I could possibly say. But there are so many good resources out there that put into better words than I possibly can on this podcast about the best steps to take. But there's a wealth of information out there. It's just sort of working through what works for you, or what you think will work for the person that comes to speak to you.
Mm-hmm. I feel like football does give an opportunity to talk to people. I know personally I've had people come to me and say things during a game of FIFA. I think FIFA might be the perfect way of like saying something where you're concentrating on something else. There's no awkwardness because you're playing, but also great time to talk. But maybe that's just me. I don't know. We've covered a lot of stuff today. Serious. Started with silly.
I have another silly one, if it's not not the worst thing to have.
Let's end with some silly then. Go on, Dave.
I've got one silly and one kind of half-serious one. Silly one is, when is Alan Shearer coming over for a brew? And can you explain what my question was?
So the 1st of January 2016, New Year's Day, I was incredibly bored at home. And I tweeted Alan Shearer saying, I'm just got a new calendar for Christmas. I'm filling it in. Just let me know when you want to come around for a brew. And he didn't reply. And so a few weeks later, I sent him another tweet asking when he was coming around for a brew. And then every couple of weeks from then on, I just asked Alan Shearer when he's come through, mix it up a bit. I had to redecorate the flat, so I had to, you know, ask him to take a rain check on when he was coming around for a brew because it was a bit messy. I got a cat, so I had to just make sure he wasn't allergic to cats if he wanted to come around. I even offered him to lock the cat in the bedroom while Alan Shearer was there having his brew. And so every few weeks throughout the year, I just tweet Alan Shearer and ask, never responded to any of them. And then on my birthday, which is in November, I got handed a birthday card by my sister. And she said, this isn't from me, I'm just the postwoman. And I opened it and it said, "To Johnny, milk and two sugars, please. Alan Shearer." So I got a birthday card from Alan Shearer, so it was probably worth the restraining order in the end. And if Alan's listening, do you want to come round for a brew?
And also, do you want to tweet about the podcast?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be useful. And finally, something we ask everyone who comes on Who Are You is kind of their favourite footballing memory. So it doesn't have to be, I don't suppose in the case of Newcastle, it'll be a famous cup final win or anything like that. But if it can be anything, either at the game or watching it on telly or just anything football related that you'd say is your happiest footballing memory.
My favourite football memory, I don't know, because I already spoke about how I don't really remember anything because I don't have from the mid-90s when I first supported them. But obviously I've been back and watched stuff, and we alluded to it earlier, and the greatest thing that's ever happened as a Newcastle supporter was beating Manchester United 5-0 in October 1996. And Darren Peacock scored, then I'm wearing a t-shirt with this on, that's just me. Darren Peacock scored, then David Ginola scored, then Les Ferdinand scored, then Alan Shearer scored, and then Philippe Albert got the ball off Robert Lee, and just with one little deft touch of his left foot, lifted it over Peter Schmeichel's head to make it 5-0, and football peaked at that moment, and it's just been all downhill from there. Not just as a Newcastle supporter, just as a football supporter, as a whole, football has not been the same since. It sort of ruptured a hole in the time-space continuum. Philippe Albert lobbed Peter Schmeichel. So that's probably the greatest, my favourite football moment.
Thank you so much for coming in and seeing us. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've learned so much and I've had a great time, personally.
Hope at least some of it was useful that you found out. some of it wasn't just...
Well, I think the point of today's chat is that there's a lot of useful stuff and there's also a lot of useless stuff, and both are very important.
Both of them are on my Twitter feed.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Who Are You? Our thank you to Johnny Sharples for being such a pleasure to talk to. You can find us on Spotify, iTunes, Acast, Audioboom, or wherever you get your podcasts every other Friday morning. If you'd like to go one step further and help us reach a wider audience, then an iTunes review or social media shout-out would instantly put you in our good graces. Thanks again for listening. See you soon.